Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Justice Society Presents, our show celebrating some of our favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond. Today's discussion is a standalone episode with a pretty interesting topic. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm one of your hosts, and along with me is my co-host, the Earth 2, Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
Happy belated New Year, Shag. We've not recorded in like 2 months.
Best 2 months of my life.
Yeah, as I said to you privately, I didn't miss you at all. this is very exciting because you are recording from a new location, right? A new Shag Cave?
Shag Cave, or you could call it the Justice Society Clubhouse, as it's called in this issue. So whichever one you care to call it.
Okay. When you told me you were moving, I was picturing that one Batman cover where he's like storming out of the Batcave and you're talking to Gina and you're like, all right, Gina, shut the old Shag Cave down forever. And she's crying and stuff. And it's like a big Doctor Who standee or something. It's all in mothballs because you're moving to Shag Foundation building in the downtown, the whatever city in Florida you're near.
We do call this one the Matthews Manor. So we do call it that. Yes, we moved brace yourself. It was a long journey. It was an entire 700 yards. So 700 yards. I, in fact, to the point where I carried some boxes by hand and walked them here just to prove I could do it.
You can look at your old house and just wave at it. Hi, old
house. We walked the dog past it. It confuses the hell out of him. So.
That's so sad.
We waited a while before we did it.
Oh, my God.
He's much happier here. He has stairs. He thinks that's the coolest thing ever. And I found out I'm so old, I get winded when I climb stairs. But that has nothing to do with the Justice Society.
No, it doesn't.
Although, by the time they were around, you know, in my beloved Mike Parabek series, they were old men and probably got winded climbing stairs, too. That's how it all comes full circle, isn't it?
Yes. Currently, you and I are in the shape that Wildcat was in when he was like 80.
Maybe 85. So, we are here to talk about a classic, as my friend calls it.
Issue at all.
I know. All-Star Comics from going back to 1945 here. We're talking about All-Star Comics number 27. Not to be confused with Detective Comics 27. A little different. So, Rob, tell me why, because I'm still not clear on this. Why did we read All-Star Comics number 27?
Well, first of all, it's an issue of All-Star Comics. It's always going to be fun. No, I will admit, everybody, this episode is a little bit of a self-serving tie-in to some other things that I've been doing on the network. I have another show as part of the network called Fade Out. And a couple, you know, over the last year that show has been on the network, comments have been made about it like, really? That's a show on the network?
that's the pull quote on the back. Yeah, the pull.
And, you know, other quotes like, no, really? That's on this network? But no, it's a show. I love the show. It's a show that I do about the final films of different people in the movie business, whether it be, actors or directors or producers. And it gives me a chance to sort of talk about their whole career, but through the prism of, like, what was their final film? Did it say something about their career? Was it a great way to end their career? Was it not? And it's been a lot of fun. We've got 13 episodes so far, and it's been a lot of fun. So anyway,
I'm really looking forward to you covering my snuff film.
That's good. In this case, Shag did not know that it was going to be his last film. Anyway, the most recent episode that I did with the writer and podcaster Jill Blake is about the director William Wyler, and you know, a lot of people that aren't really diehard film people don't know his name, but you've seen his movies. He directed Roman Holiday. He directed the Ben-Hur. He directed How to Steal a Million. He's just a funny girl. He directed dozens and dozens of movies that were like massively popular. He won tons of Oscars. And one of his movies, arguably his best movie, is 1946's The Best Years of Our Lives, which is a three-hour drama about veterans returning back from World War II and finding readjustment to life, back in life, back in America, difficult. It is a complete masterpiece. At the time, it was a huge hit. It won like 9 Oscars. He won a Best Director Oscar for it. It is an amazing movie. If you have not seen it, even if you don't like old movies, I would suggest you check it out because it is startlingly blunt for a 1946 movie about the realities of what it was like for people that had served in the war to come back and try again, try to readjust in their life. So we, even though that was not William Wyler's last film, we talked about it a bit because it looms large in his career. And then I did another tie-in over on our YouTube page, which again has been said about, really? We have a YouTube page?
I'm still trying to figure out why.
It was mostly for Chris's toy videos. I think that was right. The initial indication of it.
It's a real testament to the fact that you've got a face for radio, Rob.
Exactly. But anyway, I do a series of videos on there called Admit One, where I do trailer commentaries, where I talk over a trailer of different movies. And so to tie into Fade Out, I do a trailer commentary for The Best Years of Our Lives. I thought it would be a nice way to kind of pair it together. So there's this issue of All-Star Comics, and we'll get into it shortly, which deals with the difficulties that veterans and people who are because 1945 parents were disabled deal with in America. And it's not a tie-in. It's not like it was done in conjunction with this movie in any way, but it was an effort that the government was doing on trying to get people to be more aware of treating returning veterans, those that had been wounded in some way or disabled in some way, with respect and empathy. And I had never read this comic, this particular issue, but it sounded really interesting. And I thought it would be a fun subject for an episode of Justice Society Presents.
Oh, it's a great topic. It is a very interesting issue. The cover by itself, I mean, everything you just described about that film, and then staring at this cover, I totally see the connection right there. I mean, what you've got is a veteran who has lost his arm, and he's standing there, and the JSA are all saluting him. He's in the forefront. It's a very place of prominence. There's a big yellow circle behind him. He's really kind of pops off the page, and they're all showing the respect for him serving. And it's called A Place in the World, which is really, I can totally see how it ties in with what you just described. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, we got some heavy subject matter to address here. But before we do that, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. So, folks, this episode of Justice Society Presents is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. What'd you bring, Rob?
So, of course, tied into the idea of, the World War II and veteran serving, I wanted to pick something that was kind of war comics related, but not Sergeant Rock or anything like that, because we've kind of plugged a lot of that stuff. But I did find The Corpse on the Imogen and Other Stories by Harvey Kurtzman. And this is a hardcover book by Fantagraphics that reprints some of the legendary Harvey Kurtzman's best war comics work in Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat. And of course, Harvey Kurtzman was the guy that basically created Mad Magazine, as if that was not enough, in terms of a legacy. But Kurtzman also did some of the greatest war comics ever done. And if you look at his style, you wouldn't necessarily think it would work for war comics because it's very cartoony, but his stuff has such life to it that they really are. And the stories are gritty and hard hitting. And I mean, Kurtzman himself was a veteran, so it's not surprising that he would sort of bring this authenticity to his war comics. So this is a collection of different stories by him. Again, it's called Corpse on the Imogen and Other Stories by Herbert Kurtzman. It's 240 pages. Normal price is $28.99. In stock trades price is only $20.29. That is 30% off. So again, if you've never checked out some Harvey Kurtzman war comics, this is a good place to start.
Fantastic. Well, I went a slightly different route. I thought about, okay, Justice Society, and then thought, now this story is celebrating a diverse set of people with disabilities and how they still contribute to society. And I thought, okay, who is a disabled person in the superhero world? And first person that comes to mind is Oracle, right? I mean, she was amazing. She continued to be an amazing hero, even more effective than she was as Batgirl. In her years in the wheelchair. So I immediately went to Birds of Prey, which, by the way, also includes Black Canary and Huntress, who have deep connections to the JSA. So it's a perfect connection. The first volumes by Gail Simone weren't out there, but this one was. Birds of Prey, Fighters by Trade. Collects Birds of Prey number 81 through 91, written by Gail Simone. And in this one, Oracle faces off against the Calculator and an infection from the OMAC project. Meanwhile, Black Canary and Huntress have their own stuff going on. Wildcats in the story. I mean, it's a perfect tie into what we're talking about here. So publishers, obviously DC Comics. The artists, there's a variety of people in there. Joe Bennett, Ed Eddie Barrows, Jack Jadson, and some other folks. The cover's by Adriana Mello, and it's 272 pages. And if you've never read the Gail Simone Birds of Prey run, it is really a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful comics. It was a great period in DC where they were doing a lot of great stuff, and it's just so damn good. So this one normally goes for $24.99. You can get it for 42% off, so only $14.49. So for both these editions, go out to InStockTrades.com. Have you ever read Gail Simone's Birds of Prey?
I have not.
It's really good. I know you're not, you probably weren't into comics, you know, mainstream superhero comics at that point because you're old and crotchety and you want them to get off your lawn. But
all these, that is true.
But these are really good. Really, really good. And like I said, there's deep connections to JSA.
I've heard a lot of good things about it from over the years. Not to mention just apparently Nightwing's butt is apparently really amazing, according to Stella.
According to everybody, come on. Also, folks, with that convenient transition, we'd like to thank you folks at home for your support in helping support the network through Patreon. Because, you know, running the network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And we realized a little while back that we needed some help. And you guys really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you'd like to help us out, please visit our Patreon. What's that address, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcast.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite shows of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be mentioned on the JSA Presents show. So our thanks to Alex Osias, David Ace Gutierrez, Joe Tonello, Keechy Baker,
Jason Keen, Joshua Romano, Herman Lowe from Into the Weird, Ted Kellington, and Gord Tolton.
Again, just visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. All right, Rob. So you ready? Let's do this. All-Star Comics number 27, the first appearance of Batman.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, this comic, as Shag mentioned, the story is called A Place in the World. It's by Gardner Fox and a collection of JSA artists, because there's a bunch of different chapters in this book. There's Martin Nadell, Joe Kubert, Stan Oshmeyer, credited as Stan Joseph, Paul Reinman, and John Chester Kozlak. It was on sale November 16th, 1945. Of course, the price was only 10 cents, because that's when comics only cost 10 cents back then. Now, you did talk about the cover very briefly. Like you said, it features this soldier who, again, obviously is missing his arm, and the rest of the JSAers are saluting him. And it says, another full-length adventure of the Justice Society of America. And, you know, it's a pretty simple cover. The art is a little on the crude side, I would say, in terms of some of the anatomy and stuff. But It design-wise, it's really very beautiful. And again, I love the color. The colors are just gorgeous on this thing.
I'm reading it on the DC Infinite app, by the way, folks. If you have DC Infinite, it's on there, so you can read it there. And the colors have been all remastered. It's absolutely gorgeous. You call the art crude, but I mean, this is not that off model for what you saw in 1945 from superhero comics. So I'm fine with it. And I really do think it's nice how they made the soldier the forefront. He is the point of focus in the whole cover, which is pretty cool for a superhero comic at the time. Yep. And what exactly is going on with Hawkman's wings? What is that about?
I don't exactly know.
They're parachute.
Yeah, they are huge. It's like a strong gust of wind is going to take him away. I don't know what's going on there, but okay. So we the roll call for this story is Hawkman, Green Lantern, Dr. Midnight, Flash, Wildcat, Johnny Thunder, and Wonder Woman.
So, in parentheses, secretary.
Secretary. Yes, exactly. Because that's what you want from the most powerful being on the planet outside of Superman and the Spectre, is make her your secretary. Right, so, so, all right, let's get right into the story. There's an intro sequence. It's drawn by Martin Nadell. We meet Fred Monday, an all-star football player. Not only is Fred brilliant on the field, but he's a great big brother to his disabled little brother, Jimmy. Jimmy worships Fred, with Fred never letting on that deep down, he actually kind of pities his little brother, musing that he doesn't have much to live for. Fred then is sent overseas to fight in World War II and is gravely injured, losing an arm in an explosion. While convalescing, Fred gets a letter from Jimmy, and he realizes that he's been wrong to look down on his brother all this time simply because he's disabled. He gets angry when he sees that other people treat him like he is something less because of his injury. Fred, through his brother, then shares letters with other disabled kids and is horrified to find that they all feel the same. Determined to do something, Fred gets word to the Justice Society, who invite him to their next meeting. Fred shares the letters with the JSAers, and Hawkman gets an idea. Consulting some of their crime records, he pairs various letters up with different team members who will head to the various cities to investigate open crimes and ask local disabled kids to help, which will hopefully cheer them up. And so that is the intro to the story. And then we're going to break down into the individual stories featuring the different characters. Now, Shag, do you want to review each section, or do you want to do the whole book and then talk about it after?
Why don't we talk about this section? I mean, I kind of mix it up a little bit.
Okay.
And it's fair to mention part of the distinction in each section, too, is there's a different art team for each section, because a lot of these old All-Star comics, if you've never read them, would do that. A lot of times they would tag the artist who normally would do, like in Hawkman, you're going to see Joe Kubert drawing it because Joe was drawing Hawkman. So he would do that segment within this comic, because this was literally a bunch of different, you know, folks coming together to create this team. It wasn't standard operating procedure. This was a whole new thing, having a superhero team.
Yep.
So I think... Oh, I've lost his name. Fred. Martin?
The artist, Martin Nadell.
I think Martin Nadell did a nice job. I like his artwork. I was really enjoying his art through here. I think the story with Fred is moving, and it's very sad. Now, let's start by saying, folks, there's going to be stuff in this comic that reading it 75 years. Yeah, let that sink in. 75 years after it was published. Some of the sensitivities are not going to be the same. We live in an entirely different world, different perception. There's words in here that we wouldn't use nowadays, but the intention is there. Their heart is absolutely in the right place with this comic, trying to teach kids to recognize that other disabled people out there are just as much of a value to society. They're absolutely normal. You shouldn't pity them. In fact, you should just treat them like a normal person, is what it's essentially trying to teach kids to do, which is a great message.
Absolutely. Yes. It's very on, like, you know, reading the story, you know, getting to page one, like right on page two of the story, first page is a splash, but the second page where it's like, you know, we see that Fred is talking to his brother, and the way he immediately is like, oh, I feel so sorry for my little brother. He's got nothing to live for because he can't walk. And you're like, wow, that's blunt, mm-hmm. you know, and you know that you obviously know what's coming. That Fred is going to learn the error of his ways. But man, that's a hell of a turn to put in what, as we all know, you know, comics are meant for like kids. And then the very next page he gets, we literally see him get caught in an explosion and lose an arm. It's like, that's pretty gritty stuff for, you know, 8 or 9 year olds.
Right. Right. And it's very effective. And later on, when Fred goes to meet the JSA, because he decides he's going to get them to help him spread the word. And I love how they immediately invite him to the clubhouse. They're like, oh, why don't you just come on over?
Sure.
Right, exactly. And then they have a nice chart in here where they're trying to describe with someone with cerebral palsy how they experience and how their brain's telling their body to do something and the body's not cooperating. So they actually, to help the kids understand, they give a military illustration that they say was provided to them courtesy of a national society for these disabled people. I'm not going to say the name of it because we don't use these terms anymore. Things have changed. But anyway, it's very effective and it teaches the kids. It's educational. And I thought that was nice. I want to get to something and start picking on the story a little bit. I have to. I love how they have a crime library. They have all these hardbound giant books. I mean, these things got to be like 3 inches wide.
They look like the Who's Who collected editions.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they're like omnibuses. You're right. They've got local crime records from all around the country. First of all, who's collecting this stuff? Who's printing this stuff? Who's keeping it up to date? I mean, that means this stuff is up to date. They just got these volumes this week, maybe? I don't know. But I'm like, wow, that is absolutely fascinating that they have access to this hard copy printed collected editions.
I'm imagining the book for Florida is like way bigger than a lot of the other books. Just
we have our own bookcase. Yeah, our own bookcase, yeah.
I shouldn't laugh. I live in New Jersey, the mob capital of
exactly.
probably. Oh, well, that's there's the New Jersey wing, Dr. Midnight. Go check that out.
InStock Trades was making serious bank on selling these books. I'm just saying. Anyway, I thought the art was nice. I enjoyed his artwork. In full disclosure, I'm not a Golden Age comic fan. I struggle with Golden Age comics. I like this.
I mean, it's fine. I didn't mean to be to knock it early when I called it crude. It's just, I mean, when you think of some of the other artists that were working at this time, Jack Kirby, Joe Kubert, which we'll see in a minute, Will Eisner. I mean, they're, you know, Alex. Well, this was a little early for Alex Toth, but still, Yeah, there were a lot of great artists, and some of this stuff is a little cool. But the thing that kind of works for this segment is that it's kind of a human scale story. There's no superheroics. It really is all about Fred, and they are kind of more like real people. And so the sort of slightly kind of dumpy anatomy and cartoony looks of it sort of works. You know, it gives it like a slightly more human kind of scale. So I think it's absolutely fine. And I do want to mention, just as I said at the top of the show, this was not produced in conjunction with the movie, because the movie didn't come for another year later. They have no connection other than this was just sort of in the air in America in World War II. But it is worth mentioning, anyone who has not seen Best Years of Our Lives, one of the actors in that movie is named Harold Russell. Harold Russell was not an actor. He was an actual soldier who lost both his forearms in an explosion during basic training. And he was fitted with hooks. And so he's in the movie as playing this character with a man dealing with this issue. And it's a startling performance because he's not an actor. And so he's incredibly natural. And there are times in the movie where you're literally just seeing what it's like for him going through life, having to, you know, adjust to having these hooks for hands. And again, the movie is sort of startling. So I there's no connection here, but I thought it was interesting that is Fred's injury, is that he's lost an arm. And they don't get into that part of it here, but it's the same kind of idea that you're seeing his, a lot of the other problems that some of the other kids are going to have later as we get through the story are more invisible, but this is obvious because Fred is missing, Fred is missing an arm. So just again, I thought it was just an interesting connection that's the same thing that goes on. And by the way, I will mention for Harold Russell, he is the only actor in history to win two Oscars for the same performance.
Whoa!
Because he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, and the Academy was so sure that he was not going to win that they gave him a special Oscar in tribute to bringing like understanding and dignity to all of the disabled veterans out there. So he got a special Oscar for the performance, and then he won it.
Oh my gosh.
And after that, they had to change the rule that you can't win two Oscars for the same, that doesn't happen anymore. So he's the only guy ever to do it. And again, I'm sorry to get too far off, but Harold Russell basically didn't, he was not, as I said, he was not an actor, and he basically didn't appear in too much after this. And he ended up working for the government and being like a spokesman for veterans and veterans concerns and veterans affairs. He does appear. He did come back to be in the 1980 movie Inside Moves, directed by Richard Donner, which is the movie Chris and I interviewed Richard Donner about over on Superman Movie Minute.
That's a crazy circle of life right there. That's bizarre.
There you go.
Wow. It all comes back. It all comes back to Superman.
There you go.
There you go, Michael. Since you addressed the issue about the movie, The Greatest Years of Our Lives, is that what it's called?
The Best Years of Our Lives.
Okay. The cover of this issue really implies that's what this story is going to be about. It's about veterans reacclimatizing. And there's a little bit of that in this first section. Pretty much that's the end of it, though. The whole rest of the comic is about showing respect and dignity for your common man, or children in these cases, who have a disability. So the story does sort of change at this point, and we go a different direction. And before we leave this section, I got two more notes that are just big picture ones. And I can't take credit for these notes. I found these on the internet. So, hats off to you smarter people. So, Wildcat's here in the issue, right? Doing stuff. Yeah, Wildcat's not on the team. apparently this is the second issue where he's appeared with the Justice Society. It was first in All-Star Comics number 24, and then this one. But no explanations given how he is on the team, why he's here. And as far as they were referencing, apparently he's only in like, I find this hard to believe, but it says these are the only two issues of All-Star Comics that Wildcat appears in. I find that very hard to believe, but that's what it said. It's a DC fandom wiki, so it's usually pretty reliable. But to give you some sense of it, Wildcat had been around for a while. He'd already appeared in 50 issues of Sensation Comics at this point. But again, he's on the team for no reason. Just apparently Adam is missing and Wildcat's there instead. And then, you know, in here, when they're getting ready to go visit all these kids, you know, Hawkman pulls out little sheets of paper and I says, all right, everyone, draw a name. Well, they didn't ask Wonder Woman to draw a name. This is the only segment she's in. It's like this beginning one is the secretary. So apparently in the 1970s, in Wonder Woman number 243, they set a story during World War II, during this era, and it actually shows why Wonder Woman did not help any of the handicapped children in this story. I didn't know that, but I tried to find it. It's not on DC Infinite, so I did not get to read it. But yes, apparently Wonder Woman had her reasons for not helping, and they retconned why she didn't help during this story, which is kind of clever.
I'm sure Roy Thomas wrote something into All-Star Squadron explaining why Wildcat's in this story as well. Instead of
probably, and sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I'm sure that there's all these continuity loop-de-loops to explain all this stuff. That kind of stuff drove Roy Thomas nuts.
Well, I was going to say he probably had a hand in like guiding that Wonder Woman 243, explaining why Wonder Woman was too busy to help too.
Probably.
All right, well, let's get into it. So first chapter is Hawkman. What do you got?
Yep. It is drawn by Joe Kubert. Hey, I know that name. Hawkman heads to the Louisiana Bayou to stop some water bandits. Oh, if only there was an Earth 2 Aquaman. He teams up with a young man named Edward, a victim of infantile paralysis. Hawkman gets the drop on the crooks, but purposely holds back. So it seems that Edward, still a powerful swimmer, needs to help him, which he does. Hawkman then tells the police how much the young man was a help in this case. So as a reward, they hire him as a swimming instructor for local kids. Very nice.
Very nice, except for the whole child endangerment thing, where Hawkman turns this teenage kid loose in the bayou to swim, by the way, back to shore to get the cops. Like, Hawkman intentionally starts to throw the fight just so the kid will go swim across the bayou. Really?
No, kids were tougher back then. They're not the pieces of veal they are nowadays. Come on. I mean, look, obviously I'm a complete stand for Joe Kubert. This stuff is great. I love the way he drew Hawkman, like this rip. He was ripped. You know, I mean, a lot of back in the 40s, you know, when you were considered muscular, it was like you were like a big beefy guy.
Barrel-chested, yeah.
Yeah, you were like Superman, like the Joe Schuster Superman. You weren't cut. That's a more modern look, is that thing. But Kubert's men are cut. Hawkman has got that, you know, he's got, of course, he's you know, mostly exposed with his chest. So he is just ripped to high heaven. And I love the way he does punches. I love when he punches the one crook and the sound effect is contact.
Ah, you stole my note. I love that.
That's awesome. I just think that's great. But yeah, the whole idea. And the other thing is the slightest problem with the artwork is, as we're talking about, that he draws these people so ripped. This Edward is supposed to be kind of a kid, but he looks like Flash Gordon. I mean,
yeah, he does.
You
does.
Know, I mean, yes, he's a victim of infantile paralysis, but man, you would not want to mess with this guy. He looks like he could knock your block off. And when he's about to jump into the water, he takes his shirt off. And again, it's like he is super ripped. You're like, no one's going to mess with this kid.
Well, they tried to make a point of that his upper body strength was just amazing,
right?
To compensate. And so that is why, you know, he pulls his shirt off and it's like, wow, you know, the Rock, right? Well, he's prepping for Black Adam. He's like, whoa, okay. Yeah. You got something going here there, kid. Yeah.
And then I love when he puts his suit on in the last panel, he's like a nerdlinger again. Like he looks, it's just so funny. But anyway, it's a really fun chapter. Again, it's Joe Kubert's style will kind of morph over time. It didn't really look like this as he went on in his career, but I love the nighttime setting. There's all this wonderful scene setting of like the crooks on the boat, and there's like this frog in the foreground, and this moonlit night. It's really kind of a moody, effective little piece, and it tells a lot of story in just like six pages.
Yeah, the splash page of the like little cigarette boat is great with Hawkman landing on it, yeah. And then later on page four of the story, like there's one panel of just a house in the bayou, like that looks great. Like I'd love to see it. That's the kind of thing you'd see like in a Man Thing issue or something. It looks so good. It looks perfect.
Yeah.
My only criticism of Joe's art in here is what in the hell is going on with Hawkman's mask? Like the little wing things that come off the mask.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell whether they're like tree limbs or sometimes they're antlers for deer. They change every time Joe draws them. So yeah. It's just a little out there.
It is a very strange mask. It ends up being way cooler than that yellow hood that he would take on later. But it is kind of an awkward thing to have this sort of beak with the tongue sticking out. Like, you may, you know, imagine somebody talking to you with that thing. You're like, hello, I'm Hawkman. I'm here to help you. You're like, what's going on?
So lots of fun. So, all right, we ready to go on?
Yep.
All right. Next segment is Dr. Midnight with art by Stan Aschmeyer, I guess.
Aschmeyer, yeah.
Yeah, he's credited as Stan Josephs on the book. So Dr. Midnight travels to the Northwest to stop some man-made forest fires. Upon arrival, Dr. Midnight stops a young man named Hal from contemplating suicide. Now, Hal is blind and can't stand the constant teasing from other people. Hal ends up aiding Dr. Midnight in finding the men who've been setting fires in the timberland run by Hal's father. Using Hal's hearing and knowledge of the forest, they track the men and stop them from dynamiting a bridge. Man, dynamiting, there's a good verb. Later, Dr. Midnight and Hal find the men setting fires. Using Dr. Midnight's black-eyed bombs, they defeat the entire group of thugs. Hal earns his father's respect and decides to become a Braille teacher. So, huge contrast in the art. From Joe Kubert to Stan Joseph. Stan Joseph is much more traditional, golden age, superheroic art. You know, a simpler style, but still effective, still action-oriented. I love the dynamism in it. But it's pretty stark between the two.
I love Dr. Midnight. And I know you do, too. That's mm-hmm. part of the reason when we were giving up the chapters, I gave you Dr. Midnight, because I know you love Dr. Midnight so much. But it's you're welcome. But it's so funny, because like, if I really look at his costume empirically, it's a doofus costume. I mean, it just is. But yet it works. You know what I mean? I just kind of like...
I can't even talk to you anymore.
He's got goggles and a half moon and a red tunic and a green cape and purple gloves, like brown boots. Like, none of it matches. None of it, you know? But yet, I still love it. I look at it and I'm just like, I love this guy so much, even though I kind of like, I don't know, you know? But
I've said this in a few places before, so I don't know if you've heard it before or not. In my youth, and by youth, even as recently as like a year ago, if I ever decided to cosplay, it was going to be Dr. Midnight. I would not do anything but hire someone to build it for me. Like, first of all, I wouldn't try and assemble it from, you know, stuff I find at Walmart, so it would look like garbage. It would have to be tailored to fit you.
Sure.
But his costume is so badass. I love it so much. Like and I always fall back on the Mike Parabek version, the one he drew for that 10-issue series. That is the ultimate looking Dr. Midnight costume, and I would love to wear that to a convention or something like that. I think it's amazing looking.
I always think of the Matt Wagner drawing from Who's Who, where he looked
well. That's good.
Super
too. Yeah.
Cool. Like, yeah. I'm saying, it's the kind of thing where if you just told someone, you didn't show it to them. You just told them what the costume was. You'd say, "That what?" And then when you look at it, it kind of hangs together somehow. But I'm just saying, if you just wrote the list of detail on a piece of paper, you'd be like, "That sounds like a ridiculous costume." Like, what?
We've seen two live action versions of it so far, and they both look great. So
it's amazing. By the way, I have no idea, but I think maybe one of the reasons that the story starts with the whole idea of, you know, veterans, and then takes a shift to talking about people that are, you know, people that are disabled but are not, you know, veterans. It's because, first of all, virtually everybody that the JSA teams up with are children. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to, you know, and the audience is for children. So they're trying to
relate
really
a
little. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. Okay. And also, it could be, you know, this comic was on sale in, like October of 1945 or September of 1945, the war had only been over a couple of months. And for a lot of soldiers, it wasn't over. They were still there, wrapping up, you know, still performing their duties in terms of the rebuilding and cleaning up and things like that. And I wonder if Gardner Fox and the editors and everyone else were just, you weren't really sure what exactly how to present that information. So, okay, let's talk about, let's set the stage for saying, well, no, this is how you should treat anybody. And then you can transpose it to returning veterans, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that could be kind of what it is.
I just took it as because the comics targeted at kids.
Yes.
You know, that's who's buying comics at that point. Yeah. So that would make the most sense. That's where I was going.
Absolutely.
There's an interesting pairing here that they never draw attention to, which I didn't realize till the second time I read it, is Dr. Midnight is blind. Yep. And he's aiding a boy who's blind as well. There's no mention of Dr. Midnight being blind anywhere in the story. Like, you would think he would confide in the kid or something.
And hey, say, I'm a superhero,
you know,
right?
Right, exactly. At no point is it ever, like, if you don't know who Dr. Midnight is, you don't read his adventures, you would have no idea. So I didn't notice that till the second time around. I'm like, that's a bit odd. It's kind of like a story opportunity they missed, which was a little different.
I see that.
But again, it's a great little bit. And again, it's all about recognizing people with disabilities as they're just regular people.
Yep.
They're, you know, don't, because I guess the point they're trying to make here is don't feel sorry for them. Don't mock them. Don't pity them. Treat them like normal human beings and recognize that the gifts and talents they have and they can bring to the table when needed.
Absolutely. Yep. All right, so let's move on. So we've got Green Lantern, art by Paul Reinman. Green Lantern arrives in New Mexico and consults the help of a kid named Sven Lundquist, a young man who lost an arm in an accident as an expert on local history. There is a group of supposedly magical spirits who have been demanding offerings from the local townspeople who are gripped with superstitious horror. With Sven's knowledge of archaeology, Green Lantern figures out that these magic beings are, of course, just crooks using local history to bamboozle people. Because of Sven's help, the town mayor makes Sven assistant curator of the local museum. So, I mean, you know, I can't, this is the Scooby-Doo plot, you know, it really is. And it would have worked too, had it been for you meddling Green Lantern. But, you know, it's perfectly fine, you know, that, you know, and I like the idea that, you know, part of the reason that Sven knows so much is because, like, he's kind of shunted aside in this town. Like, they don't let him play games or, like, you know, they kind of like, oh, well, you just sit inside and read all day because you have this infirmity. And he's like, well, all right. And so he learns it, but he wants to do other things. And it ends up paying off for him because he becomes, like I said, the assistant curator of this museum. One other thing I wanted to mention is at the end, I guess it's I don't think they say who it is, the guy that makes him the assistant curator. I guess it's the mayor.
I think it is, yeah.
Of the town. The mayor is like huge. Like, he's like Orson Welles in near his later years size. And then the guy who gives Edward his job, the swimming instructor at the end, is huge. So there's something about mayors just being really giant guys. I don't know. I guess that was like, I don't know, like a cliche or something, but like every town authority that comes in at the end of these stories, it's like these massive guys. Oh, here you go, friend.
They're all Boss Hog.
they're all Boss Hog.
Speaking of the art, I love the way Green Lantern is drawn in this. Like, his anatomy is insane. His upper body is massive, just huge and hulking, and then he just kind of dwindles and gets smaller as it goes down. And it's stylistic choice, and I love it. But the way they draw his hair and his facial expressions, he looks like a Hollywood leading man. Like, he really looks like he's got that, you know, I don't know, special Buster Keaton hair or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He just looks handsome as hell. And he's always got like a little bit of a smirk going on.
I think you meant Buster Crabb.
I did.
Green Lantern looks like an old-timey silent comedian. Yeah. Oh, really?
They're both big stars. But yeah, but the Scooby-Doo plot, the part of what makes it hysterical is Green Lantern has on his finger one of the most powerful weapons in the universe. And he's fighting a couple of guys who bought feathers at the department store. You know, is what he's fighting.
Also, all he does is punch dudes.
Right, I know. He even uses the Green Lantern ring to punch
you. Yeah, once in a while, he'll like shoot some flame out of his ring. But otherwise, he just punches the one guy in the gut. Two of them, he knocks their heads together. And then the other guy with the gun, he just grabs the table and upends it. So, yeah, Green Lantern's just like, he's got this magical weapon. And he's just like, yeah, whatever. I just want to punch dude.
Right. Working in radio is a hard job. You got to let off some steam. All right. Well, moving on. Next section is Wildcat with art by John Chester Kozlak. So, in Big City, Wildcat befriends a boy named Anthony. Now, sadly, Anthony is teased because people think he is stupid and that he doesn't pay any attention. Well, what people don't realize is that Anthony is actually deaf. And Wildcat asks for Anthony's help in breaking up a gang of racketeers, because that's what you do with kids. Anthony refuses because he doesn't think he can help. So as Anthony leaves to go to work, we, the reader, discover that during his after-school job of running errands, he's actually unknowingly smuggling loot for the racketeers. So when Wildcat tries again to convince Anthony to help him, the racketeers see this and they shoot at them both. Anthony now wants to help after that. So they spy on the racketeers, and Anthony uses his ability to lip read to figure out the gang's plans, which he and Wildcat then prevent. Later, Wildcat holds a school assembly and tells everyone about Anthony's deafness and his heroics. So this is a fun one. It's a little, I felt like the setting in this one was a little weird because, like, in all the previous cases, there was a reason for the Justice Society member to approach that specific person. I didn't identify here why Wildcat picked this kid, other than the kid was disabled. Like, every kid had like a special skill set. Like, they knew the bayou or they knew the town history. Here, it's just like, hey, kid, you're going to help me stop the racketeers because you live in the city.
Who are you, strange man in cat face costume? What's that about?
Kind of a cat face.
But Wildcat, another uniform that should not work, and yet when I look at it, it looks really cool. But it shouldn't work because the guy's got cat whiskers on his face.
Right, right.
I guess that's so he can enter rooms and sense what's happening. by the way, I will say kind of as a side thing, Wildcat, the logo, his logo, is one of my favorite logos of
any
superhero. I love black lettering with this kind of like yellow lightning bolt kind of thing.
Yeah, it looks like an airwave or electricity
I know. It has nothing to do with Wildcat, but it just looks really cool. so I dig all that. But yeah, I've always liked that Wildcat has no special powers. He just beats the crap out of people.
Right.
That's his whole bit. I love that one panel where he's punching like five guys at once. Pow, bam.
Help!
It's great. So yeah, but yeah, you're right. This one is a little less, the theme of it is a little less obvious.
And those kids, they're dicks. They're really mean to poor Anthony. Like, because everyone thinks, again, their words, they think he's stupid and doesn't pay attention. But the fact is, he has a hard time. He can't hear in class, and if the teacher's not looking at him, he can't read her lips. But those kids are just horrible to him. I wanted Wildcat to punch the other kids. So.
Now, does your version on DC, the DC Universe app, come with the text piece?
Jim Robinson's More Money Trouble? I guess it does.
Okay, yep. We're not going to get into that, but I thought it was interesting on page 2. There's a little graphic where it says, this button means honorably discharged from the armed forces. Respect it. And it shows this little button that you would get because a lot of servicemen didn't wear their uniforms. After they got home, but they would maybe have that attached to their clothes. And so it was a way to show kids, like, if you see this, this is someone who did serve. I thought, again, a nice little detail there to throw in for kids. Okay. We've been avoiding it as long as we can. We got to get to Johnny Thunder. It's by the artist by Stan Josephs again. And it says, so out west, Johnny Thunder investigates crimes by the Bad Buttes Gang, a group of armed crooks who are robbing stagecoaches and then disappear into the mountains, evading capture. He meets a young kid named Tommy who stutters. So while Tommy has a tough time communicating with people, he's marvelous with animals, especially horses. Using his abilities, Tommy enlists the horses to help stop the gang mid-robbery, giving Johnny Thunder T-Bolt a chance to apprehend them. As a reward, the money offered by the bank to stop the crooks has been given to Tommy's dad, who will use it to send Tommy to a speech clinic. Not only that, but it will also be used to send Tommy to college to learn to be a naturalist. We all know how much we all hate Johnny Thunder. He's stupid. He's annoying. He's not funny. But I really love this story because, I don't know, I mean, I've never suffered from like a stutter, but I knew someone that did when I was a kid. And I don't know, as someone who gabs on as much as I do, I can appreciate how frustrating that would be to not be able to talk when you're trying to get out, you're trying to convey, what you want to say, you're trying to get things across. So I just thought it was a really nice story. And as someone who loves animals, I thought it was sweet that, that Tommy turned to be with the members of the animal kingdom because people were mean to him. They got frustrated. And I just thought that was great. So I'm going to set aside my hatred for Johnny Thunder and just talk about that. It's a nice story.
No, absolutely. And stuttering is a horrible, I mean, all the disabilities are horrible. I don't mean to imply one's worse than the other, but I had a friend who worked in the field of, I'm going to get my terms wrong. Speech therapy type sort of area. And it's very difficult because, I mean, so many people lose their patience with someone who stutters. And you can see exactly, you said, where Tommy turned to the animals. And by the way, speaking of great movies, The King's Speech, fantastic film that deals with this very issue. Now, Johnny Quick is incredibly irritating in the story. Sorry, yes, Johnny Thunder. See, I'm trying to change it because I don't even want to think about him. And I appreciate you taking one for the team here, telling this story. Even though Johnny's not wearing his usual bow tie, instead he's wearing a Freddy Krueger sweater. So, I again, stealing the notes from the internet, this one acknowledges that apparently this is the first time in which the Thunderbolt ever helps Johnny Thunder without him saying the magic word, say you. Because Johnny is he's gotten injured, and he can't pronounce words properly because he hurt his mouth. And so, but the Thunderbolt's like, Johnny doesn't want me here, but I want to get a piece of this action. So, yeah, I struggle with this one, and that's all I've got to say.
There we go.
All right. Up next is The Flash, art again by Martin Nadel. Flash goes to visit a young man named Billy who suffers from cerebral palsy. Now, they do use a very outdated offensive term in here for the disorder, which I'm not going to say, but it took me a while to figure out what they were talking about. So Billy is a young mystery writer who hasn't sold any of his stories. And he has an agent, though, who keeps coming by and buying his tales, but has no further luck in selling them to publishers or movie studios. Flash notices a remarkable similarity between Billy's stories and a recent crime wave. Following a hunch, Flash and Billy craft a new story about a break-in at a movie studio. Flash follows Billy's agent and his gang and catches them in the act, following the crime established in Billy's story like a playbook. In the end, the movie studio offers Billy a job as a writer. So I found this one super fun. I really like this one. I like the idea that this kid is writing these really imaginative tales, and he's got this guy who's just, you know, abusing his talents and giving him just $10 for his story and telling him he doesn't sell them, and then using him to, you know, as a crime playbook. But I just really enjoyed this one. And again, I find myself really enjoying Martin Nadel's artwork.
Yeah, he draws the Flash very strange. Like, he's almost hunchbacked. Mm-hmm. Like, he's really broad-shouldered. Like, almost, like, you know, he has almost, like, no neck, kind of. It's, like, strange anatomy for what he thinks of, like, a speedster. But, yeah, I like the writing angle. I thought that was cool. And the kid getting the job at the movie studios, I love it. Reality Studios. Mm-hmm. I thought that was funny. but, yeah, no, I enjoyed this one quite a bit as well. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, it was pretty straightforward, but makes a fun sort of mystery story. And I liked it. I thought it worked well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then we go right into the conclusion. Again, art by Martin Nadel. The JSA all return from to their headquarters, and Fred and Jimmy are there waiting for them from the beginning of the story. The JSAers are all duly impressed with the kids and their abilities, and they say so. Jimmy talks about all the returning veterans facing similar challenges, and that when it comes to people with disabilities, a code of conduct can be added to the junior JSA's charter. Hawkman, as chairman, agrees. Beneath the pledge, we see some of the people throughout history who have had physical disabilities but still accomplished great things. I can't say this man's name.
Demosthenes.
Thank you. Milton, Beethoven, Helen Keller, and of course, the late?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh, wow. I thought you'd do the imitation.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No.
Wow. So this was great. I mean, this was really impressive. Now, they did reference a lot of these famous people throughout the story when they would be talking to the kid with a relevant disability. They say, oh, like so-and-so who overcame it. I was a good conclusion. I was not expecting a new charter like that, but it's a nice one. It's got all the kids with disabilities on the left-hand side. On the bottom, it's got the JSAers, plus the two characters from that started the whole story, and then, the people from history with the charter. I like it. It's really nice.
It is kind of ironic that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, of course, had just died about 6 months earlier, is mentioned here as someone who has overcome physical handicaps. You know, what the popular notion was is, of course, everyone knew that he had overcome polio, that he had suffered from polio, and that he sort of overcome it. But he really hadn't in a lot of ways. He was in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. During his presidency, but most people did not know that. It was hidden,
right,
from most people. I remember asking my father, who was alive during FDR's presidency, and I said, did you have any clue? He goes, no, they didn't know that at all. So on the one hand, it was part of his biography that he had overcome this look what he was governor of New York, and then he became president of the United States, the only president ever to win four terms. the only president to ever win three terms, let alone four terms. But yet, a lot of what he overcame was hidden because they felt like the world wasn't ready for that. So they're kind of like almost making their point in a backhanded way by having him here, because it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, imagine if he had, you know, I mean, we all know history would have changed, but it's just sort of funny that like, wow, yeah, well, this is, we know what he overcame. Well, he overcame it in a sort of theoretical way, but actually he was still suffering from this. And it would have been interesting if kids hadn't been able to see that at the time, because how inspiring would that have been?
Right. Look at how much he accomplished even with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would have been amazing. But anyway, it's a really nice conclusion. And I like the whole bit about showing people from real history. And, you know, again, not to tie it into everything that I like, but there is a great episode of MASH where Major Winchester befriends a soldier who stutters. And this kid thinks has been so the abuse he's taken from other soldiers is so much that he thinks of himself as dumb because he can't speak properly. And there's a scene where he says, you know, Winchester says something like, you know, there are many great people that stutter. And the kid goes like, yeah, name one. And then Winchester goes, I'll name you several. And he lists some of these people. And then he's like, Winston Churchill. So he goes through this similar kind of list saying, hey, there's a bunch of famous people that suffered from this, and look what they were able to go and do. And so I just think it's a nice way to wrap up the story.
Yeah. Now, does this page with the charter, does it look familiar to you?
It sure does.
Okay. So I didn't know this. This exact pledge appears at the end of Justice League of America, number 36, The Case of the Disabled Justice League. The artwork's similar. It has the Justice Leaguers members instead of the JSA members. But the people of history are redrawn. It's a reproduction almost of this page. Did you catch that, or did you just see it in the notes?
No. I knew it because that's, first of all, I mean, I had that issue of Justice League, and it was reprinted in a Treasury, which is one of the things I remembered as much from it. I mean, for all I know, that Treasury might have been like the first time I ever saw Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I would have been like a little kid when I bought it. But wow. It's kind of the same story, because it's about a bunch of kids who are suffering from different disabilities, and they are unfortunately kind of shunted aside into like a hospital, kind of away from society, and the Justice League has to team up with these kids to teach them, no, they can still do lots of things even with these infirmities. So yeah, it's basically kind of the same story just told 20 years later.
Well, Gardner Fox wasn't going to throw away a good idea.
Now, nah, hey, why not?
Overall, I'm really glad you had me read this. And when I first heard you mention it, I was like, well, okay, you know, sure, why not? Golden Age comics are not usually my favorite, but I found a lot to love in here, and I thought it was a really enjoyable exercise. And the message, again, is, we look at things through a different light nowadays. There's a lot in this comic that wouldn't fly nowadays, might even be a little cringeworthy, especially some of the language. But 75 years ago, this was very, very sensitive and very, very heartfelt and very genuine. And I appreciate it for what it was.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. And again, I thought it was really interesting that in a lot of ways, all the popular media of the time was trying to teach Americans this new reality of, look, we're going to be seeing people that you know, you're not usually used to seeing. I mean, that's something that happened. That one of the developments of the First World War was the medicine was able to help save people that had suffered catastrophic injuries, but they lived, because basically before that, those people just died of their wounds. So you didn't have a lot of people coming back from war with disfigurements or obvious injuries. But post-World War I and especially World War II, our medicine was getting better and better. So more people were coming back and going on to live their lives. And I like the idea that, like, you know, in movies, this is for adults. You know, best years of our lives is for adults. But for kids, we can do this. We can have the JSA team up with kids and teach them that, you know, you can do great things. I think it's great. So, yes, it is crude in some ways, but its heart is in the right place. And I don't know. I thought it was a really fun adventure. And like I said, it left me feeling very good that it was like, yeah, this is great. This is kind of what I want a lot of superhero comics to do, is this kind of thing. And plus, it's just fun that the JSA is kind of like just a bunch of fun people to hang out with. I love that they just invite Fred to their headquarters.
It's called their clubhouse.
It's just great. You know, they're just like, oh yeah, come on over, Fred. All right, here, let's check out our crime books. All right.
The only thing that probably, you know, in, as we're sitting here talking about, the only thing I feel like they could have probably addressed because it was becoming more prevalent was mental health issues. You know, I mean, some of the terminology back then, like shell shock and things like that, as they used to call it. I mean, that was something that they were starting to become aware of, were mental health issues. They could have addressed some of that as well. But it's not worse for not having it in there. I just, it was, as you and I were discussing things were coming to mind. But either way. Bottom line, love seeing the JSA here. Love this collection of JSAers. You know, I could have used a little more Wonder Woman in it, but I love these particular heroes. You know, don't waste my time with Superman and Batman and the JSA, please. They're post-crisis. We didn't need them. We didn't need them back then either. So,
wow.
All right, that's going to do it. So, folks, go out to our website and let us know if you've read these issues. If not, check out the gallery. We'll have a couple of pages from there. Or go out to DC Infinite. You can read it. It's very available. Check it out. Or tell us some other great Golden Age JSA stories that you really, truly love that I could suffer through. So, Rob, where can they find us on social media?
Just go to FW Podcasts over on Twitter.
We also have JSA Presents.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. We do. That's the one Twitter feed I don't run. Yes,
exactly,
we do
right.
The JSA Presents Twitter feed as well.
I keep it out of Rob's hands for a reason, folks. So, yeah, all right.
Smart.
With that, until next time, everyone.
Join the fight for justice.
Parrish. Homer Parrish.
Yeah.
You Derry?
Yeah.
Parrish?
Right.
Got a call from base ops. It's a B-17 taking off for Boone City. Probably have a long ride because she's making a lot of stops, but you get there tomorrow afternoon. That suit you?
Sure, that's swell.
Okay, fine. Sign here.
Boy, it sure is great to be going home. Here you go, sailor.
Sign in a dotted. I'll do it for you.
What's the matter? Think I can't spell my own name?
No, I just thought that.
I know, sir.
Hey, Joe. You better hurry up out there, because she's taking off soon.
Right, thanks. Come on, sailor.